Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Welcome back. I hope you're all healthy and secure. If anyone has been following my now 5 weekly Dharma podcasts, you're probably thinking, this guy is probably new at this. But every week I make either a leap or a bound. This week, for instance, I'm using a new USB microphone. We've been talking about intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. In the first talk, I outlined the remarkable psychological advantages of doing things with no further goal in mind for the hell of it. In the second talk, I showed how striving for some personal goal beyond our actions themselves, although not fully avoidable, is unskillful or unwholesome according to Buddhist ethics, and so inevitably gives rise to personal suffering and is an obstacle to spiritual progress. To the extent we let go of striving for personal advantage, we make room for intrinsic motivation to flourish. But what makes it grow? This is the topic of today's talk. This is close to the question, what makes life meaningful? So I'm calling this talk the Thunder of Intrinsic Motivation. 2 weeks ago, I gave listeners an assignment to review your passions, that is, the things that you find satisfying, rewarding, and meaningful in your life in themselves, or would if you had more time to pursue them. This is by way of identifying your own intrinsic motivations. This time of social distancing gives good opportunity for such contemplation. I hope many of you are also meditating regularly. This helps develop a contemplative mindset. My own list of passions falls into 4 categories. 1, common things like play, humor, friendship, and looking out for the general well-being of self and people close to us. 2, hobbies. 3, big life commitments like educational or career path, marriage and raising a family, social activism, and so on. And 4, religious life. Common things like play and friendship are rather universal. One feature we discover there is the need for connection with others, identified in self-determination theory as a basic human need. We're not so good at that anymore in our culture. Polling data indicates that if a few decades ago, a typical person had 3 close friends, people who they could confide in, for instance. Today, a typical person has none. Interestingly, what we call hobbies are almost always, but usually implicitly, topics of great devotion: surfing, knitting, bird watching, football, fishing, collecting string, bowling, karate, model railroading, and so on. One feature we discover here is the need for proficiency, identified in self-determination theory as another basic human need. We want to get really, really good or really knowledgeable regarding our hobbies. This is where mindfulness is at home. It shifts our focus from the why to the how. We can also see a level of dedication or selfless devotion to our hobby. It's as if we give to it rather than take from it. Remarkably, we can even turn self-indulgence into a hobby. This is one of the many ways we can flip extrinsic to intrinsic motivation. It seems to me connoisseurs, epicures, and gastronomes are people who bring proficiency and devotion into what would otherwise be pure, self-serving striving for sensual satisfaction, turning, for instance, the guzzler into a discriminating sipper of fine wines and the glutton into the gourmet. The absence of practical purpose beyond the activity itself explains both why other people may view our hobbies as pointless and connoisseurs as silly, but also why our hobbies provide quite palpable and welcome relief from the relentless drive for personal advantage with which we tend to be afflicted during most of the day, replacing it with calm and joy. It's interesting how hobbies begin to take on a religious quality. They have their sacred objects, like a baseball sign by Babe Ruth or a black belt. They also have a sometimes religious level of ritual. Consider, for instance, how much ritual is observed at a gourmet restaurant in simply opening a bottle of fine wine. These I take to be natural expressions of devotion. Am I recommending hobbies as a spiritual practice? Yes, I think this is generally overlooked. Hobbies are, in their pure intrinsic form, selfless and uplifting. They have the motivational structure of mindfulness and virtue, with emphasis on the how rather than on the why. Moreover, they can often be folded into the practice of dana, or giving. For instance, I'm creating these podcasts in a Linux environment consisting of public design software produced as a gift to the world largely by people whose passion is tinkering with computers. I accept this gift appreciatively and pay it forward in offering these podcasts to you. If your passion is knitting, cooking, or origami, similar opportunities to give are out there. Intrinsic passion can accompany our larger commitments in life as well, such as education, marriage, bringing a new child into the world, leaving home on a fishing trawler to explore foreign lands, career, bringing home a St. Bernard puppy, and so on. Such commitments begin with the bold resolve, "This will now be the shape of my life." Ideally, we are on fire, much as scientists or artists can be on fire. For instance, do we go to a college to study what can turn into a lucrative profession, like business management, medicine, law, or electrical engineering? Or do we go to college to study what we really love, not that we can't love the foregoing, like medieval French poetry, theoretical linguistics, existentialist philosophy, or Buddhist studies? Pursuing our passion is likely to seem foolish to others, particularly to one's parents. But the deeper level of proficiency achieved in doing so might end up surprising everybody. Joseph Campbell is said to have written somewhere, I say, follow your bliss and don't be afraid, and doors will open where you didn't know they were going to be. If you follow your bliss, doors will open for you that wouldn't have opened for anyone else. I can report that my life bears this out. My bliss in graduate school was theoretical linguistics, not because I was following Campbell's sage advice, but because I've always been foolhardy by nature. Sure enough, trained in a field where employment is the remotest possibility, doors did open up one by one that I never would have expected. Where they ended up leading me has come as a complete surprise, and I am not aware that this particular series of doors has ever opened for anyone else. These larger commitments point to the importance of both faith and devotion. Faith is needed because we never, ever know what we are getting ourselves into. Devotion gives us the energy to persevere. Devotion often brings the sense of engagement in something bigger than oneself, to which one's personal needs are secondary. Individually, we're like a single musical note whose significance is realized only when it is embedded into a complete score. The scientist has this kind of engagement, amazed by the vastness of nature, contributing one small but necessary part of revealing its secrets. Selfless devotion is probably necessary for a successful marriage as well. Does the marriage serve us, or do we serve the marriage? With insufficient devotion, it might be a means to sex, social prestige, housekeeping, childcare, and meal preparation, or to material comfort, security, and luxury. Seeking personal advantage in this way is always a source of suffering and a hindrance to spiritual development, and the marriage is easily abandoned in favor of trading up to a more promising partner. With devotion, on the other hand, marriage is a refuge, a bigger container for one's life, likely pursued mindfully with sensitivity and deeply as a source of personal satisfaction, intimacy, and meaning. We have to be careful that striving for personal advantage can easily infect any one of our passions. The connoisseur or gourmet easily becomes a snob. We become proud of our abilities as we pursue our hobbies, enter competitions, and attach to results. I think competition is okay as long as it is not whether we win or lose, but how we play the game. Competition is a common element of play and can be a basis for connection with other like-minded people. Many of us, particularly in the beginning years of Buddhist practice, show great pride, compare ourselves to others, excel in debate, and boast great attainments in the higher meditations. When we apply the higher meditations to achieving mystical states, perhaps known only to ourselves, we are also striving, craving, and suffering, which are actually impediments to the calm and composed mind. When we meditate for its own sake with no goal in mind, because that is our way, simply out of devotion, that is best. Intrinsic and extrinsic orientation have become key concepts in the modern psychology of religion. Religion and modern psychology started off on the wrong foot after Freud bluntly declared that religion is not only associated with mental illness, but that religion is mental illness. Although Jung had a different take than Freud, for years empirical evidence remained elusive that religion produces any substantial benefit to mental health. Religions bring, for many, meaning and joy, but often have an annoying side, particularly other people's religions. A major shift in our understanding of the psychology of religion began with Gordon Allport in the 1950s, who observed a difference between what he calls mature as opposed to immature religion. In later work, he renamed these intrinsic and extrinsic religion, respectively. The intrinsically religious sees religion as an end in itself, not trying to extract some personal advantage. Their attitude is variously described as genuine, heartfelt, devout, and as living their religion. They find their religion the master motivation in life, harmonizing all other needs with this master motivation. The extrinsically religious, on the other hand, sees religion as instrumental in satisfying non-religious goals. It provides social connection, sometimes status, and often self-justification. Experimental studies show that intrinsically religious people experience more meaning in life, and there is an overall highly significant correlation between intrinsic religion and robust mental health. However, religion seems to have a way of attracting scoundrels alongside the devout who, for instance, find therein excuses for their own unethical acts and attitudes. Rather than living their religion, the extrinsically religious use their religion. We all know of Christians who cherry-pick the Bible, for instance, for ways to justify much of the hatred and prejudice they in all likelihood had prior to picking up the Bible. In Myanmar, the generals who ran and substantially still run the country very brutally for half a century take every opportunity to pose for cameras as devout Buddhists. Allport asserts that most of the popular criticism of religion applies to its immature or extrinsic forms that have not evolved past self-centered interests, that are unreflexive and provide no context of meaning in which the individual can locate oneself and assess one's own conduct. They just don't get it. He also points out that the religiously immature tend uniformly to exhibit similar lack of reflection toward their parents, toward political issues, and toward social institutions. He speculates that the preoccupation of many schizophrenic or depressed people with religion is the effect of mental breakdown, not the cause. Before Allport's work, much of the early research on the psychology of religion in the USA had been concerned with its relationship to prejudice, particularly racial prejudice, and had pointed to a positive correlation between general religion and prejudice, a punitive attitude toward criminality and drug abuse, and general intolerance and bigotry. Once these two types of religiosity were identified, the high prejudice of the extrinsically religious majority was seen as masking the relatively low prejudice of the intrinsically religious minority. Devotion and a degree of foolhardiness provide a sense of wholehearted commitment that motivates Buddhist practice as intrinsically meaningful and satisfying in itself. It is how we experience its thunder. Devotion has a similar motivational structure as mindfulness and virtue, but at a higher level, the higher level of overall life commitment. That is, it focuses our attention on the how, and even while we can expect benefits, puts aside the why. It is through devotion that we completely inhabit Buddhist practice and understanding, rather than utilizing the practice of Dharma by striving towards some goal outside of the Dharma itself. We settle into this simply as a way of life. When we practice for its own sake with no goal necessary, simply out of devotion, that is best. This requires a great deal of faith because, I can report after decades of practice, along with foolhardy people like Marco Polo, we really never know what we are getting ourselves into. I still don't, but can report great satisfaction, meaning, and joy in what I have so far gotten myself into, as well as benefit both for me and for others. The devout Buddhist develops trust in three sources of wisdom, which we trust to guide us in our spiritual development and how we conduct our lives. These three sources of wisdom are, first, the Buddha, who is the awakened one, the historical founder of Buddhism. Second, the Dharma, which is what the Buddha taught, or a functionally faithful representation of what the Buddha taught. And three, the Sangha, which is properly the community of monastics, but more practically, living Buddhist teachers who live the Dharma. Together, the three are known as the Triple Gem, and trust in the Triple Gem is known as refuge, which is also based on confidence in our own capacity for practice and awakening according to its standards. Trust in the Triple Gem is what first turns our heads resolutely toward virtue, wisdom, and serenity, and will grow progressively more discerning and acquire more depth as we repeatedly have the opportunity to check things out in our own experience. The Dhammapada says, "He who has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha penetrates with transcendental wisdom the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the Noble Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of suffering." On the basis of refuge in the Triple Gem, we open our hearts and minds to the influence of the teachings of the Buddha, and then we begin wholeheartedly to study, practice, develop, and gain insight into them. Refuge is the center of our devotion, a home we inhabit in lieu of unwholesome striving, a safe and nurturing context in which our practice unfolds, rather than a place we would rather be. Refuge means a place of safety. Triple Gem carries the same implications, for gems in ancient India were regarded as having protective powers. In settling into the intrinsic satisfaction of refuge, devoid of extrinsic striving, we experience the thunder of our practice. Let me leave you with another assignment for contemplation. We all have both intrinsic and extrinsic motivators in our lives. Consider what extrinsic, that is the bad one, motivations play out in your life, or used to play out before you started staying at home, if that's what you're doing. Consider their conditioning factors. Force of habit is likely to be a big one. Fear of losing your job, TV advertising. If you're like most people, you're assaulted by extrinsic motivators at many different levels, including socially and culturally.